Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Here with me today is Michael Pewitt. Michael wrote the book, The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. It's an excellent book. It helps to explain the idea of why and how philosophy is applicable to our everyday lives and how we can impact our leadership and our success as leaders based on our understanding of what some of these Chinese philosophers and even the distinction between cultures, between Western culture and Eastern culture, can teach us. Michael is a professor of Chinese history at Harvard University. He has a very popular course there on this. Michael, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thank you so much. An honor to be here.
So Michael, would you just share with the listeners a little bit about why you wrote this book and the big idea behind it?
Absolutely. So the book is, as you said, on Chinese philosophy, and I have found that these ideas really fundamentally challenge many of our assumptions about the world, about ourselves, about how leaders can be successful. And so I decided to teach first a course, bringing these ideas to a larger body of students, and the hope of the book is to do the same, to allow these ideas to enter into our way of thinking, and my hope is here too, to really challenge some of our fundamental assumptions.
So you talk about philosophy not being some kind of abstract thought exercise, but it's a guide to living our lives. How is that different than religion?
Yeah, I was stunned when I first started reading Chinese philosophy because I expected it to be very exciting, of course, but very, very abstract and dealing with what I thought to be the big questions of life. And they do deal with the big questions of life, but they get there by means of very practical concerns of how you live your everyday life. And in terms of religion, it's similar in a certain sense, but of course here too, a lot of religions deal with the so-called big issues. What is reality? What is really out there? And here you have philosophers who are really focused on how you build a successful community, how you actually work with other people on a daily basis. It's a very surprising way to think about philosophy, and I found it an extremely successful way to think about philosophy.
One of the things that you talk about is this idea that we take for granted the way we live, that we think we have choices. And I've heard a lot of different authors that I've been talking to, Lee Ross, a lot of the social scientists, talk about this idea that we think we have free choice, but in reality, we are very much, our actions are very much ordained in some way by the culture that we live in. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So the Chinese philosophers would agree complete with what psychologists are now finding to be the case. And so as you said, psychologists are discovering that actually we like to think we are individuals deciding for ourselves how to live our lives, what to do moment by moment, thinking through the big decisions of life. And psychological experiment after psychological experiment is showing, actually, no, we are largely passive in the world. A lot of what we think we're doing in the world is simply a result of very minor things, a frown, a smile, that will affect our emotions and then affect our so-called decisions throughout the day. And then as those accumulate over the course of a lifetime. Now, that sounds very negative. So as you said, a lot of people say, therefore, sadly, we have no free will. We're simply passive in the world. The intriguing thing about these philosophers we're discussing in the book is they say, yes, that is the case. That's their opening starting point. And then they will say, but if that's the case, it doesn't mean we should simply therefore be passive. Then their question is, okay, then how do you alter these interactions? How do you alter these conditions? How do you alter these habits and patterns we fall into? And that, they will argue, is how really big things come. The big decisions, successful communities, it's by altering these and working with these and creating worlds within which people can actually flourish.
So I find that fascinating and really important in organizations, right? Because organizations have their own culture, and the culture of an organization determines how we act, and we don't even necessarily realize it. I sometimes describe it as the invisible walls we bump up against when we hit them. And if we're new to an organization and we begin to learn, oh, these are the cultural mores, and these are kind of the things I'm allowed to do and not allowed to do, and the culture is developed. What are you learning from the Chinese philosophers about how we can shift that dynamic, how we can change the way we act in the face of a culture that's somewhat determining how we act.
Indeed. And let me say, your analogy is perfect. They would fully agree. And it's a nice analogy because, as you said, if you're walking through a building with lots of walls in it, at first you might be banging into the walls, but then over time you just start walking through those rooms and down the hallways, and you would just accept that naturally, and that just becomes the way you exist when you walk into that building. And your analogy is perfect. That's how we tend to be if we're in any kind of a community or any kind of an organization. We just sort of fall into these patterns of being. And oftentimes we kind of don't recognize them. And we certainly do, as you said, when we begin to at the organization at the beginning, but over time we lose that. And then it just becomes our habit of being. So to get to your question, they would say, if that's the case, and they certainly think it is, they would say it's equally the case that even surprisingly small alterations in these habits and patterns, or sticking to your analogy, sort of shifting those walls or breaking some of them down or altering the way people walk through them, can have incredible impacts on the nature of an organization.
So in a sense, our role, our goal as leaders of an organization is less to just try to shift behavior in the context of walls that are directing people in the wrong direction, and more to shift those walls to, in effect, impact the culture in a way, in the organizational culture, in a way that shifts the flow of traffic of people's behavior.
Beautiful analogy. And that's exactly right. So your goal then, if you're running an organization, is precisely to do this. It's to try to be incredibly attentive to these patterns that people are falling into, many of which are very harmful for an organization. And then you're constantly working to shift the flow of people in these organizations. Just to give a current example, a lot of companies have made what I think is a brilliant move of saying, well, let's literally tear down the walls and try to build cooperation by getting people to simply interact more. And I would say, for many organizations, brilliant move. But of course, even there, simply not having a wall doesn't mean people will necessarily interact more, and some could get paranoid that they're being watched. And so even there, you're constantly wondering, well, are there things I can do to build more cooperation, which is often little things like just the way meetings are run, the way the physical space is organized, tones of voice that that you as a leader use when you're sending out memos. These surprisingly little things can have an incredible impact on the entire working of an organization.
You mentioned that in the book. Why are the small everyday rituals, you talk about these small minutiae, everyday rituals that these philosophers talk about, that they're so important? Why is it that they're so important?
If it's the case, and I'm convinced they're right that this is the case, that we tend to be kind of passive in the world and just falling into these patterns, what it means is most of what we are doing in the world is also affecting others in not necessarily good ways. If you're running an organization, the little things you're doing can really be undermining what you're doing in ways you wouldn't even imagine. Like you might not realize that the reason people are going against a certain policy idea you've presented has nothing to do with what you've said. It's the content. It has to do with the resentment that's been building up because you did something else altogether unrelated, and that's just been accumulating over time.
We're all very familiar, too, with that in relationships, right? In any kind of relationship, it happens all the time where you get a response and you sort of say, well, where is that coming from, right? And the answer is, well, that's coming from the last 15 years of, like, the way you've been treating me.
Absolutely. Yes. And then the key, and that's a perfect analogy, is to say, so early on in the relationship, what happens if you become attuned enough to catch these as they're developing and begin making the alterations? So if you're running an organization, what happens if at a very mundane level, you begin to pick up on these resentments that are developing and you start doing little things to shift them? And those little things then start accumulating as well.
So let's take an example of that. And, you know, one example of that might be that there's a sense that senior leadership or senior management doesn't listen very effectively. And so when senior leadership comes in and asks a question, people blow it off because they know that their answer won't make a difference. And at that point, what you're saying is little moves that the leaders can make about conveying the fact that they have heard, that they've listened, can dramatically shift the organization.
That is absolutely right. And yes, it's simply those little tiny moves can have an incredible impact, and over time can truly fundamentally alter the entire atmosphere and workings of an organization. Absolutely.
Do the philosophers have some advice as to how to keep those sort of minutiae, those rituals alive and energized? I know for me, when there's a ritual that I do over and over and over again, it begins to lose its power.
Right.
And I wonder like what they have to say about these rituals continuing to be energized and alive.
Yeah, great question. And they would say that if rituals are working, they tend to break us from the patterns that we're falling into, often these negative patterns. And that means if they simply become rote things that we're doing, they just become a bunch of more habits that really are having no impact on us.
They're the new patterns.
Precisely. And therefore not necessarily any better than the old patterns. And so absolutely, you're constantly trying to do little things to alter the rituals, in a sense, to break these new patterns you've fallen into, even if those new patterns came from the rituals. And part of the argument of this would be, and it sounds pessimistic, but of course there's the optimistic side, any pattern we fall into can be dangerous. So even if you create a wonderful atmosphere in an organization and you think you've pulled this off, well, almost assuredly something is going on that you're not picking up on. And so you're constantly trying to be attuned to this, attentive to this, and constantly thinking, how do I shift things just a little bit to keep breaking down these habits and help trying to keep things productive?
I wonder what they have to say about habits that break habits, meaning are there certain habits that predictably will help us interrupt our habitual response and approach the moment in the moment? There's a sense in the book I read also about this idea that every response should be context specific, right? That you can't respond in the same way every time. So what do they have to teach us around that?
Yes. And so, for example, if in a meeting people get attuned to the fact that if they say a certain type of thing, it will bring a certain response from you as the leader, that's very dangerous because it means they will simply fall into, oh, I know how to make a smile, or I know how to get, or how to avoid the frown. And as soon as that pattern sets in, it's very dangerous because it means they're not really going to be speaking what they're thinking. They're actually going to be talking to get that smile and avoid that frown. And so what you're constantly trying to do is to break that. And one of the things that really works then for rituals is there are things that break these patterns in ways that would undermine what we tend to fall into. So in that example, if someone seems to be saying the sort of thing that makes you smile, give a kind of surprising response. In this case, I wouldn't say frown, but ask something else to make it clear that, oh, I see that you're simply saying something to please me. So ask it something sort of questioning to make it clear that, no, I really want more information on this. I really want to find out what you're thinking.
I love that. I think you're saying something really interesting, which is that you so often hear about the importance of consistency in leadership. What you're saying is there are ways in which as leaders we should be inconsistent, because that inconsistency will keep people on their toes a little bit and keep them more honest in terms of the kind of ideas that they offer and the ways in which they work together, so that they're not just trying to please you, but they're trying to achieve an outcome that you've all set to achieve.
Precisely. So if you tend to respond to situations in certain ways, always be attuned to the fact that's probably creating a dangerous set of patterns. And it's always worthwhile to then shift that. Absolutely. If in a meeting you tend to call on one set of people first, don't. Self-consciously, don't do that. And try to endlessly break down these patterns that will inevitably develop in any organization.
You talk about Mencius, who's one of these philosophers, and he talks about training our emotions. I find that that's incredibly important in organizations and in leadership. And you know, most of what I read about emotional intelligence, I find to be highly unemotionally intelligent, meaning most of it is all very intellectual and very analytical and very mind-based, but the emotions aren't. I'm wondering what Mencius has to teach us about how do we train our emotions?
Yes. So we tend to think of decision-making in one of two ways. We tend to think we either rationally think through a problem, Or, and sometimes we sort of do them in combination, we go with our gut. And we tend to think the rational part is the mind, and the gut, of course, would be our emotions. And Mencius's point here would be to say it's wrong on both counts, that your mind not really thinking about emotions, in other words, not working with the emotional qualities of these interrelationships, is likely to make very poor decisions. But equally, simply going with your gut, as we tend to say, is going to be your emotions at a very untrained state. And what you think of as, oh, this is how I feel a situation. Well, the truth is how you feel a situation probably has a lot more to do with these patterns we've been talking about. It has to do with all of these patterns that have developed of you know, resentments about this, anger about that. And so what you're trying to do here then is to train these emotions, to train your responses so that you can actually sense situations effectively. And getting to your question of how, what this would mean is, well, let's go back to the meaning example. Note the emotions that are brought out, both in you and those around you, when you simply shift how you talk, tones of voice, who you're looking at, and as you begin to play with that, you get better and better and better at sensing how, yes, things you're thinking are actually directly affecting what people are doing. And you're really, as Mencius would say, training your ability to sense people effectively.
So there seems to be a recurring idea here in all of these, which is mix it up, which is don't fall into your sort of habits. And there's something that I think you write about Confucius saying, which I've also seen a lot in social psychology and actually in religion. I know it in Judaism, there's this concept called na'aseh v'nishma, which is to do and then to listen. That you won't necessarily understand it ahead of time, but just follow a practice and then the practice will guide you and understand. And Confucius talks about as if, you know, act as if. Yes. And it seems like some of this may not feel natural to people, that you're asking them to not smile when they're actually feeling good about a response that someone's given them, but that they should kind of manipulate their response a little bit for a higher purpose in order to free the sort of habitual rut that people might be in and bring in new ideas and bring in new relationships and kind of disrupt ineffective patterns.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. Absolutely. I mean, we tend to think that to be good individuals, we need to be sincere and authentic to who we really are. And that seems like a good idea. That's how we would define our lives as we want to live them, be a good leader according to our best, most gifted qualities. But actually, these philosophers would say, no, no, that actually incredibly limits what we can do. Because the fact of the matter is, if you say, I'm going to be authentic to who I am, what you're in danger of being authentic to is simply these sets of patterns that you've fallen into.
So how do you balance that with enough consistency so that you're predictable enough that you're trustworthy?
Yes. And the answer is, as long as you're someone who is constantly training yourself to sense others well, respond well, sense situations such that you're trying to act in ways that will bring out the best in those around you, that is what people begin to see as the consistent quality of you. And so they're not associating you with a certain personality trait. Oh, this person is just someone who gets angry easily, but tends to have good ideas in the late afternoon. I mean,
Yeah. No, that's very powerful because it's kind of saying that that kind of consistency that you're describing, that kind of consistency can actually be untrustworthy. That you lose trust with that kind of consistency, but you want to have the consistency of you know, focused on the higher purpose of what it is that you're doing and a willingness to be flexible spontaneously in order to move forward and achieve that.
Precisely. And that's what people end up implicitly. Oftentimes they won't even be able to put it into words, but that's what they associate with you. They associate, when I walk into that meeting, there will be an atmosphere in that meeting by the way it's being run, that exciting things will happen, ideas will be flourishing. And that then becomes what people associate with you, as opposed to, again, a personality type that by definition, they will end up gearing their statements toward, which is always dangerous.
That's great. You talk about qi and this idea of energy, and I find it fascinating and really important. And my question to you is, how can we talk with business leaders about energy inside of them? How do you bring this into a leadership conversation without being dismissed, you know, without kind of like looking at this as an idea that's just very, very foreign in in American and European leadership, for example?
Yeah, great question. And I agree. I found that the same thing with my students, where initially people hear these terms, oh, energy, and they think, oh, well, this is just not something I have to take seriously. But the truth of the matter is, we actually are thinking about and even use terms associated with energy constantly. I mean, we will always say things like, oh, that person is low energy today, or that person's a good leader because he's always high energy. So we use these terms, but we don't really think through the implications, which would be, in this case, well, if you don't simply think someone is high energy or low energy, but rather think of everything as being based in, and I'll use the term, chi, in these energies, you begin thinking very differently. You begin realizing, oh, actually, the entire energy of a room is altered by simply the way, to go back to our example, you're running a meeting, the tones of voice you use, the ways you act, and sometimes in a counterintuitive way. I mean, simply acting really upbeat may or may not be actually the most appropriate way to build a good energy in a room. And so what the term energy really allows you to do is to sense these alterations in energy, to sense when, for whatever reason, an organization or at a more mundane level, just this meeting, things seem to be ebbing and not really working as well. And then you start doing little things to build up that excitement. And they would say, well, think of excitement in kind of a literal way. It's the energy that really is developing when people are cooperating and connecting very effectively.
Which follows this whole idea of a culture, the invisible walls, the sense of atmosphere, energy in a room, is not necessarily simply possessed by a single person, but it moves through the group. It you know, shifts how people show up in a certain way. Do the philosophers have insights for us into how to shift that kind of energy? Is it something that happens, you know, over time, but the same way that Mencius was talking about training our emotions, is there a way to train ourselves at being able to master some of this energy?
Yes. They would say that what really tends to bring energy to situations and relationships is when people are really connecting well, which would mean that if a situation is developed, which tends to happen all the time, in which people feel that they really are not connecting. So again, you're in a meeting and people are really not connecting. You're getting frustrated because you're not being heard. That's what tends to sap your energy. And what tends to develop it is when you really feel that things that are being said are affecting others, people bounce off of that. Things are really moving because people are bouncing ideas off each other and really connecting well. That's what builds energy. And so what you're constantly trying to do is notice why people aren't connecting. And then again, these little things, simply tones of voice, looking at someone who seems to be feeling left out of the meeting, bringing up something that they said at the beginning of a meeting to sort of bring them back in the conversation. These are things that can very palpably affect the entire energy of a room.
You could see how great speakers, great preachers, people know how to manage the energy of a group and to bring the energy up and then down and then up and then down and then slide in for a nice finish, that they're actually managing, mastering, they're playing with the energy of the group.
Yes, it's a perfect example. I mean, someone who is incredibly effective at giving a speech, this is what they're doing. They're always looking at the audience, and as they speak, they are sensing when things are working well, and they know precisely when to build toward that crescendo, and they know when to pull things down, calm things down, make a few difficult statements, and then begin to build things up again. And the ways they're able to do that is they're just constantly sensing the room, sensing how the tones of voice they're using are affecting people. And once you're attuned to this, you can get incredibly, incredibly good, not just in giving a speech, but again, even running a meeting, even simply listening to someone's ideas, the little things you do will actually bring out the energy of that person.
I love it. Michael Pewitt, thank you so much for being with us. The book is The Path, What Chinese Philosophers Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Michael Pewitt, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for the next great conversation.